Thank you for standing by. This is the conference operator. Welcome to the Aurania Resources Limited Exploration Update conference call. On the call with us today, we have Keith Barron, Chairman and CEO, and Richard Spencer, President. As a reminder, all participants are in listen-only mode, and the conference is being recorded. After the presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. To join the question queue, you may press star, then one on your telephone keypad. Should you need assistance during the conference call, you may signal an operator by pressing star and zero. I would now like to turn the conference over to Keith Barron. Please go ahead.
Hello, everyone, and thank you very much for joining us today. Richard Spencer is going to do an exploration update for you. And so I'll let our president take it away. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Keith, and welcome, and thanks very much for calling in and taking the time. We will be having a Q&A session afterwards. We'll try and keep the presentation relatively short to give as much time as possible for everyone to ask their questions, and some questions have been sent in already, so we'll deal with those first after as soon as the presentation is finished. So Aurania is an exploration company that is focused on southeastern Ecuador, and I must just be upfront and say that obviously we will be making forward-looking statements, and all those comments are on page two of the presentation. And then just as a very high-level overview, so we've got about 208,000 hectares contiguous concession in a mountain range on the southeastern part of the Andes, 42 mineral concessions, and we've been drilling there for a while. It's a jungle-covered area, very high rainfall, and so we depend on drilling very early in the exploration program to ensure that we can actually see the rock, that we can see the geological continuity, and so we drill earlier than most companies would drill, and the reason for that is the intense jungle cover. And we call that drilling scout drilling. So we've drilled about 15,000 meters or so. We continue with that at the moment. So we've done basic exploration over this, most of this area. It's never been explored before. And the exploration that we've done it's broad-based enough that it'll pick up any mineralization that's there, any metals that are there. And so what we found from that broad exploration net, if you like, is the indications of gold systems, which we expected to see. There are indications of porphyry systems that are copper targets, and we expected to see those because both of those kinds of deposits are found in the area adjacent to us in the south, which is a very well-endowed gold and copper belt. And then in addition to those two kinds of targets, there's a third and fourth type that we didn't really expect to see there. The one is the sedimentary hosted copper, and the other one is silver zinc that's also found in sediment. So those are the four kinds of deposits that or styles of mineralization that have turned up in our exploration of the area. And just finally, the exploration team does have, and the management team does have, a lot of experience in the adjacent belt. So on page four, we show the concession area in the southeastern part of Ecuador, the red area on that map. And then, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the contiguous area to the south of us, to the bottom part of that slide on page five. Our concession area, again, shown in red at the top part of that diagram. And the point of this slide is just to show that there is a huge endowment of both gold and copper to the south of us. This is the same geological trend that we're in the red area. So we would expect that, you know, our whole exploration approach is to find multiple deposits. We're absolutely focused on discovery of multiple deposits. The one difference is that in the southern area, it is more deeply eroded, so many of the deposits are actually exposed at surface. Many of the porphyries that have a very good endowment of copper in them are actually exposed at surface. You can feel them, you can touch them, whereas in our area, they tend to be a little bit deeper, they tend to be covered, which is, you know, it complicates our exploration a little bit. It's not daunting. It's just one of those things that we have to live with in that area. So on page 6, focusing in on the concession area itself, the project actually naturally divides itself up quite nicely into an epithermal area down in the bottom left. And in fact, there's a second epithermal belt in that sort of blank area that's starting to emerge at the moment. And then we go up into the area in the orange circle where the main exploration for sediment-hosted copper is focused. Then all the red blobs where the silver-zinc target is. And then in green, the two principal areas for copper and gold exploration through these so-called porphyries. Catasham is a target that I'll talk about in a minute, and also Awacha is another area that's emerging and sort of jostling its way up in the profile and in the priority listing. So, you know, one thing that I should just reiterate while we're talking about this is that, you know, we get a lot of feedback from shareholders saying, hey, guys, what on earth are you doing? You're talking about gold one day, you're talking about sedimentary copper, then porphyry copper, then, you know, sediment-hosted silver and zinc, and, you know, what is it that you're focusing on? We're focusing on discovery. You know, we feel that our job is to create value for shareholders, and quite honestly, it doesn't matter whether that comes through a silver discovery or a gold discovery or a copper discovery, and we believe that we have potential to make multiple discoveries. And so our field teams, the geologists that are working in the field, all of them are focusing on, you know, there's a group that's working on the epithermal stuff for gold. There's another group that's working on the sedimentary copper, and it's a third group on the porphyries, and a fourth group on the silver zinc. So, you know, all of those guys are working in parallel, and the news that we release just is, you know, whatever happens, we feel happens to be topical at that time. So we're not jumping around. We're extremely focused. And that's the reason behind why the news might be sort of perceived to be jumbled. The last cities on page 7, which was the original premise of us getting into this area, and that's the reason that Keith originally applied for the concession area. The black and white image in the background is the mountain ranges, the topography, so the flat areas of the valleys. And, you know, we've been a little bit quiet on the lost cities, the search for those two gold mines that we believe are in this area. But, you know, the fact that we've been quiet doesn't mean that we haven't been working on it. In the top, there are a couple of little sort of temple-shaped icons up there. And those are areas where there were two really, really well-developed cities, Wapalo and Kilamope. One of those, Wapalo, is projected to have had about 10,000 inhabitants. They seem to have been sort of Germanic in origin because everything is from the LIDAR, squared streets, drainage, all the rest of it, extremely organized. And those guys lived there from about 500 BC onwards. had very fine pottery. And, you know, what we're beginning to realize is that there was a trade route that joined both that area of high population at a nice, flat, great agricultural area. And Wapalo and Quilomope were joined to the Amazon by that route that's shown there. We're picking up bits and pieces of that route and, you know, just beginning to realize how crucially important it is. And those three stars that are there are salt springs that are still important to the Shuar today, where the Shuar are producing salt from those fountains today. And that salt would have been fundamentally important. It would have been a huge trade item of enormous value for the Amazonian people who have no access to salt. So, you know, we're beginning to realize that there was an infrastructure in this area before the Spanish arrived, and the colonial Spanish that we believe mined the two gold deposits of Logroño and Sevilla. And so, you know, this ancient road that's been there for thousands of years and used for thousands of years is in the green and yellow. And then there's a sort of white with a red margin road going up to the north, completely different style of road. It's cobbled. The rest of the road is not cobbled. And we think that that's the Spanish road. And we feel that that road that goes, that's marked in the white and red, goes up to where Sevilla was located, and you know, we're obviously doing a bit of quiet work in the background there. So, you know, there've been a lot of questions about what we're doing, where we're focusing, when we're going to get access, and the access is opening up now nicely. So, we'll be talking more about the lost cities shortly. That work is going on in the background. Turning over onto the next page. Tiria Shimpia, the silver zinc target. We've drilled four holes there, hole four. We're pretty excited about. We've decided not to to drill hole five yet. And the reason for that I'll come on to in a second. We're going to wait for the results. They should be back shortly on hole four. And once those results are in, we'll say what our plan is for the Tiria Shimpia area. So those results are due in December, and we'll publish them as soon as they come in. Turning to the sediment-hosted mineralization, and you know, we've used the term sediment-hosted rather than sediment-hosted copper, because this applies to the sediment-hosted silver-zinc as well. We've just had Gregor Borg on site. This is him working with the geologists in the core shack there. And, you know, Gregor he spent his entire career working on not only copper, but lead and zinc and the silver comes along it in basins. And, you know, so we were looking at core both of the red bed hosted mineralization, which is mainly copper dominated, and then the silver zinc that we've seen in the limestones as well. And what is incredibly exciting about this is, you know, we've been talking for a while about linking those systems, and if we do link them, they constitute a belt that's 55 kilometers long, which is massive. And, you know, obviously the deposits are going to be little pieces along that 55-kilometer trend. And, you know, what was so incredibly exciting about Gregor's visit is that, you know, he confirmed a whole bunch of textures and things that we were seeing in the core, where we could see it in the same textures in the red beds, and we could see them in the limestones. And that helped us, and he confirmed that they were the same thing. So, you know, he helped us confirm this sort of fundamental relationship and link between the silver zinc in the limestones, which is a different kind of rock, to the copper in the red bed. So, you know, we made so much progress during Gregor's week-long trip there, and he left treading on air. He is just so excited. And yeah, I'm going to go into a couple of technical details here. Well, in fact, not so technical, because I'm going to be referring to Irish porter cheese. But you know, one of the things that Gregor confirmed is that you know, we're seeing on the right-hand side, that's a photo of core, so it's about 5 centimeters, 5.5 centimeters wide. And these are little fragments of limestone. But where the black arrow is, you can see that they're actually embedded into each other, which means that that limestone was soft at the time that it was deposited in the sedimentary layering. And why this is important is that that limestone would have formed on the shoulder of one of the faults. So if we go across onto the vertical profile on the left-hand side of page 10, you see the sort of bottom light brown stuff going into the sort of reddy brown. You see those faults, and they have a high shoulder on them. And that's where the limestone would have developed. And then it's these breccias where that limestone, when it was sort of cheese-like in, you know, so it was sort of hard, but it was still like cheese, reasonably soft. It was hard enough to break, but as it slipped down that fault, it then, you know, it was breaking as it went, and then it collected in the bottom of the fault. And what is so crucially important about that is that says fault that we drilled with this texture on it, shown in the core on the right-hand side, and we've called that texture the IP breccia because it looks exactly like that porter cheese that we've shown in the bottom graphic, and that's exactly what it is. It's a cheese-like thing that accumulated there. And the importance of that is that it says that fault was moving, and that fault was likely to have been pumping the metal-bearing fluids into that area. And, you know, the egg-shaped blow-up of the vertical slice on the top left, you know, that shows our model of the metals coming up and being moved up by those faults and then precipitating along the bedding. And so that Irish porter cheese texture is telling us, hey, that fault was moving and it was pumping these fluids. So it's a detail, it's a technical detail, but it absolutely tells us that, you know, we're close. Okay, this is one of the faults that you need to pay attention to. Going on to page 11, you know, the other thing, we've been talking a lot about evaporites and the importance of the evaporites. And you know, the evaporites are just reactive layers. They're important because they are seals. And, you know, our whole model for the be it copper or silver zinc is related to metals moving in these fluids around the basin. And, you know, we've got proof that we're dealing with, and this at the top is a photo of a salar, the Uyuni salar in Bolivia. These are massive, extensive things. And, you know, now we've got the proof that we're dealing with exactly a salar, but, you know, it's 150 million years old. And these things are important in terms of copper, lead, and zinc mineralization. So we just have different textures, the boreholes. So we've got an image from hole 7 on the right and hole 8 on the left, just showing the different textures that we get in different parts of the salar. And going on to page 12, I mean, you know, all we're trying to do is see where we were in relative to that salar, because it's important in terms of the mineralization. So on page 12, we've got the salt, that sort of translucent carroty red stuff is a potassium salt, the pale yellow stuff, the urine colored stuff is the ordinary table salt. And then, you know, those are all different textures that we see that just says that the salt that was on the right-hand side has now migrated out of those rocks, and that migration is important because it makes the rock permeable, it makes the sedimentary layering easy for the metal-bearing fluids to get into, and it's also important because the sulfate in the rock provides a mechanism of capturing the metals. So, we've made huge progress in our understanding of where we are in these Salar systems. We can use this zoning to move towards the most sort of prospective part of that Salar system. So on page 13, you know, again, this is a vertical slice through where we're drilling at Senken. Hole 9 should start in very shortly. If it hasn't started, I haven't actually checked this morning. But, you know, in yellow, we're finding those are where those Salar systems there are, the so-called evaporites that have, critically, they have salt, but they have the sulfate in them. And the sulfate is the thing that will give up its sulfur to the metal-bearing fluids and capture that metal as a sulfide. So, you know, with Gregor, we reviewed hole 6, which is crucially important, hole 7, hole 8. And, we're beginning to identify where those salt layers were and where those targets are. So we're drilling hole 9 at the moment. We're excited about hole 9 because it's close to where the fluids would have been brought up by the faults. Moving across onto page 14, this is Tadasham. The mobile MT data, the lower left graphic looking from in plan view, looking from above. The red is the conductivity, so we would expect more sulfides in those areas. And the sort of gray hedgehog in the bottom left is the 3D model, the 3D inversion of the magnetic data. So there are actually two kinds of data represented here, the magnetic and the gray, and the conductivity from the MMT in the color. And, you know, the profile on the top right is just a slice. It's a vertical slice through the graphic on the bottom left. And the pineapple looks like a porphyry. And the conductive area around the edge is, it's what one would expect to see on the edge of a porphyry. This Tadasham is partly covered by up to 400 meters of sandstone. So, you know, it's a little bit of a complicated target. It's not something that we want to drill one hole on and believe that we'll get a direct hit. We need to approach this a little bit cautiously. Therefore, it's been juggled a little bit in the priorities. The next page on page 15 is a watcher that's emerging. It's moving up the priority listing. The pink body, and these are all plan views looking down from the top, the pink body is the conductivity, like was shown in red on the Tadasham model previously. This is very, very conductive stuff. The little blue bodies, the sort of blue-gray things, those are the magnetic bodies. And, you know, that target number one looks like a porphyry. It's about a kilometer wide, which is typical of a porphyry. Porphyries are they can be magnetic. And having the magnetic thing in the middle and then the pink conductive zone around the edge, that looks like a porphyry. Target two, that's a donut with all this conductivity around the edge of it. Maybe the porphyry is not magnetic in that case, but our target for the porphyry would still be in the middle, because in the middle of the donut, because the pink stuff is likely to be around the edge of the porphyry. And in fact, you know, that piece that sort of trends down to the bottom of the diagram, that long thin thing, that might be a third target there. But anyway, the blue dots are the molybdenum, the green dots are copper. Both of those, obviously the copper is typical of a copper porphyry, but so is the molybdenum. And the molybdenum doesn't move much in the soil. So this is pretty exciting stuff. We feel that, you know, going back to our history of discovery of porphyries in the southern part of the belt, this is what San Carlos or Aurinsa would have looked like. So And it looks as though it's not covered, so it's a simpler target, and this is why it's been moved up in the priority ranking. Latour SC, we continue to different team working down there and moving it towards target definition. I'm not going to dwell much on that. And now, just to sum up, I mean, we've had a couple of questions on COVID. Our COVID infection rate in Q4 so far has dropped down nicely. We only had one person infected. There is a new wave coming, but you know, we're maintaining our COVID protocols, that's all I've got to say about that. I mean, we're keeping all the protocols in place. And then, on page 18, please keep the questions coming. Carolyn is the one who's most reliable. She can track down Keith and myself. And with that, I'll hand over to Carolyn to deal with, just to read out some of the main questions that have come in so far, via email.
Okay, thanks, Richard. Just to cover off a few that I think you tried to cover during the slide presentation, but just so that we're answering those questions. I've got a question about the allocation of drill rigs to targets. I know you went through this, but maybe just so it's clear for everybody.
Yeah. So we drilled hole 4 at Tiriashimpia, and we stopped drilling there. We're watching cash very, very carefully. So we've stopped until those results come back. We've just started, or we should have started this morning, the drilling on hole 9 at Sanken. And again, we'll probably stop the drilling after that and wait for those results to come in. We're preparing Tanakam for drilling, but as I mentioned, it's a bit of a complicated target. We are trying to advance a watcher as quickly as we can to get that drill ready, and Latoria will probably come after that. So our priority at the moment is probably a watcher next for drilling, then Tadasham, and then Latoria C. We've slowed down the drilling. And, you know, the reason for that is we're watching every cent, as obviously we've always done, but the Ontario Securities Commission has wanted us to ensure that the last raise, that overnight marketed offering and the concurrent private placement, that provided enough cash to keep the company going for a year and to ensure that we have enough cash to pay for the concession fees and all that kind of thing. So that is good for the shareholder. It's great because, you know, it gives us a year's worth of runway. The flip side of that, where we are under a little bit of pressure, is that we don't have as much for exploration as we would like to have, and that was very clear in the prospectus. And so we're being very careful with our drilling and our burn rate. So that's why we've slowed down the drilling a little bit. And you know, to be perfectly honest, I think that probably works in our favor, and that we have time to look at the holes, we have time to get the results back. What it does mean is that, you know, if like for Tiriashimpia, for example, having stopped after hole 4, the results will come back in December, and then based on those results, we might decide to do more drilling there. It means that we will probably jump around a bit more with the drill rig, but you know, it's just to be very, very, very careful with cash.
Okay, and maybe you can comment on access to a watcher.
Yeah, watch has been one of those areas that has been elusive in terms of access, like in the southeastern part of the concession block. I'm happy to report that there's been phenomenal progress. We have three steps to take in the watcher area, and two have been successfully taken in the last couple of days, and we're due to take the third one in the next couple of days. So, you know, we should have the green light to get in there pretty smartly. And, you know, as soon as we do get the green light, we're going to flood it with geologists.
Okay. And then there's a question about Lost Cities access. When can we expect to be on the ground exploring in the concessions that
Yeah, you know that's the same area as a Awacha, and although Awacha is a porphyry target, you would have noted from some of our slides that we've got the word gold in there. It might be a porphyry copper gold cluster, and very often where you have those kinds of porphyries, and there are many examples of this in Ecuador and Chile and Peru. You have gold-bearing veins, some of which can be extremely rich, sort of sitting on the shoulders of those porphyries. So, you know, and you could see by that slide on the Lost Cities, the one Spanish road that is a cobbled road, so it's a very different style from the very old roads, that seems to go up into the Awacha area. So, you know, we're thinking that once we look, all I can say is that the geologists who are going in to do the exploration on the porphyry target at Awacha are absolutely primed to look for old workings there as well. And there, you know, there is some indication of stuff up there in the LIDAR as well.
Okay, thank you. Next question also relates to Lost Cities, and this might be one for Keith. The recording from Malmo, Keith couldn't comment on the location of the Lost Cities. Can he comment now, or has there been no progress on securing the site access on or off our area?
No comment.
Okay. All right, nope, I'll move none. On. I'll move on to the next question. What will it take to deploy the third rig? Is the reason for parking the third rig until a discovery is made purely economic, or do you still need to refine the target site at Lotori C, for example?
I would say that it's absolutely economic. So to be clear, we're drilling with one rig at the moment, and that is purely economic. So, you know, since our marketed offering that you know, because of the stipulation by the Ontario Securities Commission that we had a runway of a year, which includes, the concession payments in March and all that kind of thing, it's limited the amount of money that we've got available for drilling and exploration in general. And I'm not complaining about that. I think, you know, the Ontario Securities Commission, their job is to look after the security of the investors. So, and that's good. It just means that, you know, we've had to go back, and we if anyone mentions the word budget to me, I'll have a heart attack, because we've been in budgeting mode for the last couple of weeks. We're being really, really careful with the money, seeing what we can trim, because whatever we can trim from any other thing, be that social engagement, be it environment, be it corporate, that frees up a little bit of cash to go to the drill bit. That's what we're involved with at the moment. So third rig is out of the question at the moment. Second rig is a possibility, but the way we are at today is we're using one rig. And, you know, as I mentioned previously, the sort of pause to give us a chance to get the results in and all that kind of thing, I think is going to allow us to be a bit more efficient in terms of burn rate, we're literally waiting for the results to come in from hole four and on Chiriashimpia to know whether we've made a discovery there, and then on the basis of those results, we'll evaluate whether we bring in a second rig to do any more drilling there, or whether we continue to make it to look for a second or third discovery.
Okay, thank you. Next question, will we do a joint venture without a discovery hole? And then I guess second part of that question, what is to be expected after a JV deal is sealed, be it Senkin or Chiriashimpia?
I think I'll answer that, but I'll answer it in a minute. We'll go through all these questions first. I'm going to make a bit of a statement here in a minute, okay? Can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead, Keith. Keith? Keith, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, I don't know when this mute button is muting me or not. I'm sorry, I can't tell from the phone. So what I just said was that I'm going to address the question about JVs in a minute or two.
Sure. So go ahead with your statement.
Oh, okay. Well. Now, you saw from the corporate presentation about the COVID situation, and let's just hope for the whole world that we're most of the way through this damn thing. But you saw that from the outset, we've had 55% of our employees with COVID. Last year, of course, we were shut down from March until June, and then after that, we were only allowed 50% of our complements, both in the field and in the office. Now, we broke the rules in the field a lot because we didn't have anyone looking over our shoulder, but our numbers were reduced, and sometimes communities went from red to green and then back to red. Also, when somebody got COVID, we had to isolate and put into quarantine everyone else who worked with them. And I don't think anybody out there realizes the seriousness of this situation, but of course, the whole world's had to deal with this and with lockdowns and everything else. But this is one of the reasons why, you know, we didn't have a lot of progress last year in terms of our field results. And, you know, quite frankly, the share price over the last year has not been very impressive. I'm not happy with it. We had to deal with the COVID situation. Let's hope that we're getting through the thing now. And it's almost done. And as Richard said, we've only had one case in the last quarter, which is fantastic. But, you know, really, the shareholders have to cut us a bit of slack here. We are subject to all the regulations of the federal government here, and we have to follow things. And let's just hope that this new variant doesn't take hold. And if it does, we are going to shut down our activities immediately and conserve the cash. I want that message out there loud and clear. My foundation is doing a sports tournament, a football tournament right now for 10 villages, actually 20 different teams, 10 men's and 10 women. And we have had no cases of COVID amongst the players, no cases of COVID amongst the spectators. All of these folks are Shuar, so they're all the indigenous people in our area, and that's fantastic. So let's just hope that this, you know, we're on the backside of this whole pandemic thing. Second point that I want to raise, 5 days ago, the Bank of Montreal, BMO, came out with a report on Warintza. Now, I can't attest to the accuracy of this report because this is not our property. We haven't reviewed it or anything. I'm just going to tell you what's in the report. Now, it's 15 kilometers south of our southern boundary, more or less. They have 12 drill rigs on the thing right now. The company is at $1.4 billion Canadian market cap. That's as of 5 days ago. Now, BMO has done their own number crunching in the back room. These are not numbers that Solaris is saying, but BMO is saying that they have in sight 1 billion tons of 0.5% copper, 33 and a half years of production. And I would say, looking at their drill pattern, they've drilled about 10% of it so far, and that makes this thing potentially a massive size. BMO is calling it a potential super pit. The mineralization seems to be 5 by 7 kilometers long. And if you saw the graphic that we have on Awacha, it's not that big, but it's getting there. Certainly very, very interesting for us. And I just want everyone to be aware that the shareholders that bought into this thing before, Solaris has really taken off in the last 2 years, but people who have stuck by us for the last 4 years, you have lucked into the world's best proximity play, the world's best proximity play, because we have porphyry copper type targets on our property. And I can tell you, Awacha is very, very compelling. It does not have, it's not covered. So there's QSP type alteration, that's quartz, sericite, pyrite, in abundance, right on the surface. And that's why we're getting both the moly and the copper in the stream sediments. It's fantastic looking. Anyway, so, please, folks, don't fixate on individual drill results. These are not what the majors are interested in. Major companies don't look at this stuff and suddenly throw a fit and call things dusters from one individual drill hole to the next drill hole. We are playing the long game here. We're not trying to goose the market. We're not running a pump and dump, and we're not building mining dynasties. But we are looking for situation here where with these massive, massive mineralized situations here on the property, the copper silver and the zinc silver together is 55 kilometers long. Who else in the business owns something that's this big? And I can tell you there's no one. The only ones who do is the communist government of China, in China. That's the only people have something that's 55 kilometers long and mineralized like this. This is potentially something that can make a real dynasty for a major mining company. And, Gregor Borg has talked, he's found collapse breaches and tailless breaches in the drill cores. Now, okay, so that's not going to maybe excite the market, the retail market, but I can tell you right now that these are very, very intriguing things for a major company because it shows that there is porosity in these rocks and potential to have precipitation of copper and zinc and silver on very, very large scale. This is a real, real milestone for the company. So just to finish here, we are reaching in our exploration. We're getting up to, critical mass here. We're getting to the limit of what a junior company can do, quite honestly. 55 kilometers long mineralization, where the hell do you put the drill holes in that? I mean, a very, very big company would be very interested in that because potentially there's going to be several mines along that strike length. And that's the attraction. So we are thinking and talking we've had folks in the data room for some time, but don't be at all surprised at some point when we will be talking seriously with someone about joint ventures. This has been the plan of the company now since the inception. We are not building mining dynasties here. We're not intending to go into production, and I'm not going to be beguiled into that. The exit strategy here is to get JVs and then get various chunks of the project sold off and get the best deal that we can for the shareholders. So that's the end of what I've got to say here, and I'll let you take it back, Carolyn.
Okay, thanks, Keith. Do you want to address that question that I asked earlier? Will we do a joint venture without a discovery hole?
Sure. If somebody wants to joint venture without a discovery hole, there's a saying in the mining business, please don't start firing flames at me and saying I'm a misogynist. But you don't undress the bride before the wedding. And you know, we are not going to go and put ourselves up against the wall and spend huge amounts of our budget drilling holes that realistically a major company is going to drill anyway. You know, as I've said, and we have a very, very major potential world-class discovery just on our southern boundary. We have geology that looks very, very similar, and the shareholders can draw their own conclusions whether that's valuable or not.
Okay, thanks, Keith. Can you go into a little bit about what's to be expected after a joint venture deal is sealed?
Well, you know, there's nothing on the table right now, just to be very clear. But pretty standard joint venture for a company such as ours would be potentially giving up 60 or 70% of the project for maybe some cash, but usually it's an expenditure on the project. So the major company has to spend the money. And it's an earn-in over time, so there have to be several milestones that are met before there are certain percentages that the company earns in. This is pretty standard in the business, and at the end of the day, and depending on how long the joint venture would last, you know, I would prefer to have things that were taken, they take us all the way to a pre-feasibility or even a feasibility. Sometimes if things are looking really, really good, you can get taken right to production. That's unusual, though. Usually the junior company has to find its proportion of the money to build the mine. But, you know, that's rather a moot point because quite often, and quite seriously, when you get to that point, often the major will just gobble up the junior partner and acquire them. So, but in any case, you know, if we continue to raise money and dilute the stock and push a lot of paper out, it's going to have really the same effect, if not a worse effect, than doing a joint venture with a major. If we do a joint venture with a major, we have credibility, we have access to their bank account, and also access to their expertise. And that is a real, real major component of why we do things like this. I don't pretend to be an expert on all facets of geology, and neither does Richard or Jean-Paul. We're doing the best we can, but, you know, there's a lot of stuff here that's well, Gregor Borg has really given us an education. You know, he's got more years in that type of target than I do. Yeah, no, you know, you pull in one, two, three majors, whoever it is, I don't know, and you get access to their team.
Okay, thank you.
And Carolyn, if I can just add to that, I mean, many of the JVs that have been done in Ecuador are of the type that Keith is talking about, where you know, the company gets carried to completion of a feasibility study. That would be our primary goal in a joint venture negotiation, because it means that both sides are absolutely aligned at the end goal, getting to the definition of the discovery or the deposit as quickly as possible. And secondly, just to reiterate, you know, what I mentioned earlier about the natural grouping of the gold targets and the copper targets and the sedimentary copper and the sedimentary silver zinc. You know, the property is sort of naturally divided. It lends itself to multiple joint ventures. We're unlikely to do a joint venture on the whole thing.
Okay, thanks. Just in the interest of time, I'm going to try to quickly go through these questions so we can open up the floor to Q&A. I have a question here asking how deep and thick the mineralized layer is at Tiria Shimpia. And then just along with that, how long will it take to get drill assays back?
Okay, so we won't comment on thickness at the moment, and the reason for that, I'm not just BSing. The intercept was at about 50 meters, between 50 and 60 meters, so shallow. And the mineralization has been oxidized. In other words, it's been weathered and rusted. So it makes it a little bit difficult to estimate grade because it's not the sort of bright, shiny stuff that people have seen in photographs from Tuyo-Simpia. It's a sort of pale orange clay-looking stuff. And that's why we're being very, very cautious about what we're saying about it in the press release and everything. So, we'll talk about that as soon as the results come in. And, the results should be in December.
Okay. Sorry, Richard, did you comment on how long it typically takes to get drill assays back?
It takes typically 6-7 weeks, something like that. In the case of Tuyo-Simpia, we put them in for rush assay, which is typically 3 weeks, and but it might be 4 because the labs are under a bit of pressure at the moment. So in December we should have it.
Thank you. And I have one final question here about
Carolyn.
Peru.
Can you hear me? Carolyn,
yes,
can you hear me? Yeah, I just want to add, we are subject to securities law, and not all of our shareholders are on this call. And the broad public, and we are very restricted from what we can say publicly about the thickness of mineralization and grade without presenting that in a formal press release. I know that a lot of our retail shareholders are not really aware of the rules, but we have to follow the rules. Thank you.
Thanks, Keith. And I'll turn this last question to you before we open up the floor because we're running out of time. Keith said in Malmo that we could expect news about Peru soon. What's up with this?
Ah, okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
You're just going to have to wait and see on that.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I think we can open up the floor for Q&A, and then I'll turn that over to you guys.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. To join the question queue, you may press star, then one on your telephone keypad. You will hear a tone acknowledging your request. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing any keys. To withdraw your question, please press star, then two. The first question comes from Mark Reichman with Noble Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Good morning. So it appears that you're beginning to focus on the targets that you want to move forward, at least, on page 7 of your MD&A, plus maybe Curepan and Awacha. And I was just wondering if you could discuss your plans, mentioned in your financial filings to reduce the number of concessions in Ecuador by 50% by March 2022 and your plans in Peru. I mean, I know that the concession fees go up, so if you cut them 50%, you'll be level with last year. But what impact might that have on the ability to do JVs, or is it can you cleanly define the concession areas such that you're able to still move those key targets forward?
Yeah, Mark,
Richard, we lost you there.
It's on mute.
Keith wanted to take the question.
Yeah, I'm going to take that one. I'm sorry, I can't see if I'm muted or not muted. I'm very sorry about that. That's all the confusion here that's going on. It says in the in the document that we would drop ground. That's not necessarily true. What we would do is offload the obligations. So I'm not necessarily in favor of dropping ground and getting nothing for it and nothing from it. But we do have to get out of those obligations. Now, the concession fees are not going to double because we have been, like all the other players in Ecuador, we've been given an extension. And that's because a lot of the permits, including water permits, were not forthcoming from the governments. And some companies that had drill targets on their property were actually not even able to access them for 4 years because of lack of a water permit to do the drilling. So they've got extensions. Our extensions are anywhere up from a year and a half to actually 3 years. It depends on where it is on the concession. So we don't have a massive bill coming up next March. So that's what I've got to say about that. Thank you.
So just as a follow-up, so the information's, for example, in the MD&A, that's obviously, you know, you have the filing requirements and et cetera. So that's kind of a plan, but I guess what I'm kind of taking away from this is there's quite a bit of wiggle room. In other words, you know, if you just take it face value, you know, the footnote where it says, you know, to reduce the obligations and that you're not going to spend any more money in Peru, obviously as an exploration company, you know, you're not generating revenues, you're dependent on the capital markets to continue to fund your efforts. So a lot of that will hinge on the capital market access, but there's still going to be some play in terms of the exploration budget for next year and the targets that were identified, and also just how you approach the concession decisions.
Mark, that's correct. And you know, I think we were pretty clear in the prospectus and in the MD&A that, you know, our intention is to do something with Peru, the properties in Peru, prior to mid-year next year when the concession fees are available. So, you know, as Keith mentioned, there will be news on that, you know, it'll unfold over before now and the end of June.
Okay, and then also just on some of the drilling, I thought it was kind of intriguing your last release, and I was just wondering how the information from holes 7 and 8 kind of informed your geologic understanding of Senkin and 1, and maybe the positive implications that it might have for additional targets. And then second, how are you feeling about the concept of a link between copper, silver at Senkin, and the silver zinc at Tiriashimpia?
Mark, you know, the big thing from Gregor Borg's trip was the confirmation of the possibility of copper mineralization in the red beds. You know, I had been pretty negative on that because I couldn't see a way of precipitating the copper in the red beds. But, you know, once he was able to confirm that these strange sort of broken rocks, the so-called breccias, were the footprint of where there was salt, and that does two things. It gives us a precipitation mechanism. So I was absolutely wrong in thinking that there was no precipitation mechanism in the red beds. There absolutely is. And it comes from the observation of that broken rock, which is the footprint of where that salt layer was. And these salt layers would have been like a salar today, you know, tens of kilometers in extent. So the salt moving out of that layer does two things. It creates permeability because it breaks up that rock, and you know, it allows the fluids to get into that specific layer, and it's easier for the fluids to move along that layer. A fundamental second thing is that the salt is with this mineral called gypsum, which is a calcium sulfate. And the sulfate is what gives the gives up its sulfur to take the metal out of solution and precipitate it as a sulfide mineral. So there absolutely is the perfect mechanism for extracting that metal out of the fluid, and you know, obviously to form a deposit you need a big concentration of that fluid, and the evaporite layers, these layers of salt and gypsum, that key sulfate mineral, is it provides the permeability, it provides the seal to stop the fluids from moving everywhere, it provides a way of concentrating those fluids, and certainly it provides a way of donating its sulfur to the metal to make it precipitate. So hole 6 was crucial because it hit the salt dome. Hole 7 was fundamental because it hit this thick layer of evaporite, and crucially, right underneath that evaporite is where there's this pyrite enrichment. And so what that says is the whole mechanism is working, because that the pyrite says that fluid that got to that part where we hit where we drilled hole 7 was rich in iron. That had dropped its copper and lead and silver and zinc already. Only iron was left in that fluid, and it saw the sulfur in the sulfate in the evaporite layer, and it precipitated. So it's the proof that mechanism works. And you know, one other little bit of proof that we've got in there that is spectacular is that the evaporites contain a lot of a metal, an element called strontium, and so the only place in a basin where you would get high concentrations of strontium is in the salar, in the evaporite horizon, and lo and behold, the pyrite bearing zone has got strontium in it. It's got very high strontium. And that is the last piece in the puzzle that says absolutely this sulfur that precipitated the iron to form pyrite came from the evaporite, because we know that because of its strontium content. So, you know, the model is absolutely working. And, you know, we didn't have it in today's presentation, but we had one of Gregor Borg's prior graphics where it showed, copper zone going through the zinc zone into the lead zone, copper, lead, zinc, and then pyrite. And hole 7 hit that pyrite. And we know from hole 7 that the whole mechanism that we're talking about works. So, hole 8 was important because it showed us where there was this footprint where a salt horizon had been. So that layer is another target. And, you know, in hole 9 where we've sited it, should go through that same target of hole 8 and then down into the one that we got at hole 7. But, you know, again, where hole 7 hit pyrite, hole 9 is close to the feeder of faults where that fluid should have dropped its copper.
Thank you very much.
The next question comes from Terrence Ortsland with TSO. Please go ahead.
Actually, Keith, you're speaking. You go first.
Okay, I just, can you hear me now?
I can. Because I'm sure we all can hear.
Okay. I just wanted to say, remember 2 years ago, Gregor Borg talking about a double whammy. This is the only basin, as far as he's aware, and he's worked all over the world, that has both porphyry coppers intruding into it and sedimentary hosted copper, and potentially the low-grade halos on what are apparently shaping up for us as a couple of copper porphyries on our property. They would have been mobilized by all that salt into the sediments. You know, basically, I'm talking here. We are interested in baiting the hook for the majors here, and this is a very, very interesting scenario. I'll let you go ahead, Terry.
Thank you, Keith. Maybe we should wrap up this thing with some headline issues. One, next door, Peru had very inconsistent information and policy and strategy this week, and then reverted back to some normalcy, but the cat is out of the bag. The neighbors is becoming a bit more restricted for majors to be involved in and to consider joint ventures, for instance. So Ecuador still shines in our books, but I don't know what other things happening there. I probably can give an update, including the fact that like Rio Amarillo is one discovery we had this week as well, which is not next to Alpala. It's 35 kilometers away. So the district play is becoming quite important, and that one of the holes they had was spectacular, obviously. So there is a lot of mineralization in this country, and the country may be wondering when the shovel is going to go in. The question is that you are talking about the joint venture, and I heard from Richard talking about joint ventures. So it's not a singular thing. It's probably a plural thing, the way you may dissect the area and also segment it. Plus, not one deal or template may work. Some templates work whereby there is a time element, what it's with expenditures, and then partnership starts and so on and so forth. Who's the operator going to be? Another one can be different. Number one will be joint ventures, possibility, because one will do it. Other ones will be also looking, you know, on their rearview mirror, what they're missing, and they may be interested in that. And secondly, are you going to be the operator? And three, in a sense that, how would you dissect at the area? I'm just wondering.
Terry, look, you know, I think that it's relatively easy to dissect the area by target type. You know, so geographically the areas are reasonably well defined, so I think it's realistic to do multiple JVs. And you know, the last thing that we want out of a joint venture is a company earning a 50% holding in the block for having expended X million dollars in the field. And, you know, that kind of joint venture just absolutely doesn't work for us, because then, you know, you hamstrung. They stop spending and they've got 51% or whatever, and then, you know, you're absolutely against the wall. So, you know, we will not go for that kind of joint venture unless, you know, we're forced into that situation. The joint venture that we would like to go for is the one where, you know, you get to the feasibility study as soon as possible, because that means that the majors are aligned with us and with our shareholders. We, you know, everyone's goal is to get to the joint venture, you know, to get to the definition of the deposit and the economic study and the completion of that economic study as quickly as possible. I mean, you know, the way that some of these companies, the big companies, can throw money around, you know, they can spend $10, $20, $30, $50 million in a flash, and you know, sometimes don't achieve terribly much with that, because it's a rounding error to them. You know, to us, that would be a disaster. If they spend $50 million and get us to completion of a feasibility study, then that's great. But we don't want to be hamstrung by, you know, a big expenditure coming in and not actually achieving all that much.
Well, okay. The B part of the question was, would you be the partner whereby you'd be operating the exploration program?
Terry, I don't know. I mean, you know, I think our community relations are such that would be one part that we would, you know, very much like to keep ourselves. And I think the majors respect the relationship that we've built with the Shuar. And certainly, if I were in the shoes of a major, I wouldn't touch that. But you know, as Keith alluded to earlier, you know, you know, the majors have expertise that we don't have, and you know, if they wanted to take over the you know, the technical exploration program, and you know, they have better knowledge than we do, better expertise in that particular field, be it looking for porphyries or sedimentary copper or whatever. You know, it's an absolute pleasure. Our goal is to get to definition of a deposit as quickly as possible.
Well, there's no secret how many majors are in the country looking or active or prospecting. So that's a given. You don't have to get anybody, I assume, brand new coming in, although everybody's looking as well. But next door neighbors, as I said earlier, with this risky proposition, uncertainty, I'm sure they're mining countries, they may fix it up eventually, but it's not immediate. And here, we have discoveries, shovels ready, some of them actually. So, and the government still looking for the shovels to go in, and that there should actually something they would see. And there was an expo, I believe, the last few days or weeks. How did they go? Anybody attended that? And what's the government's expectations in terms of next year?
And Terry, you know, I think, you know, two points. I mean, the one that you make about many majors being here is obviously absolutely valid. But, you know, what's exciting as well is that some of the people that are in our data room are majors that are not in country yet. And, you know, I heard Mark Bristow of Barrick say something the other day in an interview that I thought was jaw-dropping. You know, someone asked him about, you know, that same old question about political stability and, you know, why he can work in places like the Congo and all that kind of thing. And Bristow's answer was that if you actually really do want to make a difference to the world, you've got to go to the places that need most help. And then he quoted all sorts of numbers and statistics as to, you know, the impact that their operations have had in a place like the Congo. And I thought, good on you. You're not one of these people that's hiding behind, you know, political stability and saying, ah, well, I'm not going to work there. And then, you know, and I mean, we are absolutely engaged with the Shuar, and I believe that we are making a very a positive impact on them. And to hear the CEO of a major recognize that as one of the fundamental sort of basic things of being a human being, I thought, good on him. I've never ever heard a CEO say that, and I was I think he needs every accolade from that attitude.
Good way to finish the discussion. Thanks Richard.
This concludes the question and answer session. I would like to turn the conference back over to Keith Barron for any closing remarks.
Thank you very much. Hopefully you can hear me. we'll just wrap this up. Some very, very interesting stuff coming out of the field. And, you know, some very interesting developments, both in our general area in Ecuador and elsewhere in Ecuador. As has been commented, Peru and Chile as mining venues are not looking too great these days. I attended an expo here called Ecuador Open for Business last week. There were 500 delegates from foreign countries here. It was fantastic. The president spoke. This is certainly one of the premier places to go for mineral exploration on the whole planet. Thank you so much for your participation and for listening. And stay well. God bless.
This concludes today's conference call. You may disconnect your lines. Thank you for participating and have a pleasant day.